Well, a little more than a year into his first term in office, President Nixon had approved a plan to expand domestic spying inside the United States, not only by the FBI, but by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Like Donald Trump, Nixon viewed journalists as enemies of the people, and he also viewed dissidents and protesters as agents of chaos. Now, under Nixon, the CIA began an unprecedented spying operation on more than 10,000 people inside the United States. They were anti-Vietnam War protesters, black activists, other dissidents. These operations flourished under Nixon, but some of them stretched all the way back to the 1950s. And this is relevant because when the CIA was first established in 1947, the law stated that the CIA could not conduct such domestic spy operations. When the crimes of Nixon and Watergate are discussed, it's pretty common for the narrative to be the one about operatives working for Nixon's re-election campaign, breaking into the Democratic National Committee's headquarters at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. in 1972. The men who carried out that botched bugging operation were known as the Plumbers. But this criminal entity had already been in operation before that break-in. In fact, they were created to stop leaks, hence their name, the Plumbers. In 1971, the Plumbers broke into the office of a psychiatrist in an effort to dig up dirt on the whistleblower who was responsible at the time for the single largest leak of classified information in U.S. history. I'm talking about the Pentagon Papers. The man responsible for that leak was Daniel Ellsberg. He was a former senior defense analyst who'd worked in a sensitive position at the Rand Corporation during the Vietnam War.
Nixon didn't like this man.
What Ellsberg really boils down to, I mean, the discrediting and all the rest, what it boils down to, I didn't want to discredit the man as an individual. I couldn't care less about the punk. I wanted to discredit that kind of activity, which was despicable and damaging to the national interest.
By the way, as we reported recently, the Trump administration has been listening to pitches about creating its own private security force to circumvent the CIA and other intelligence agencies. And it's also obsessed, like Nixon, with stopping leaks. And there are at least 27 active leak investigations going on right now. Anyway, Dan Ellsberg is famous for the Pentagon Papers, but he has a new book out that tells the story of the other classified files that Ellsberg took at the time, but never actually leaked or published. And those dealt with U.S. plans for nuclear war in the 1960s. Ellsberg is now telling that story in his great new book. It's called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And Daniel Ellsberg joins me now. Dan, welcome to Intercepted.
Very glad to be with you, Jeremy.
What's your assessment of where we are right now with Trump and how it compares to some of the history that you yourself lived?
Right now, Trump is making threats of nuclear weapons, which is not a first with him. All of our presidents actually have used our nuclear weapons the way you use a gun when you point it at someone's head in an encounter. And if you get your way without pulling the trigger, it's the best use of the gun. That's why people have them a lot. Trump is using his nuclear weapons right now, for that matter, as is Kim Jong-un. But the difference is that this is the first time in over half a century, it's the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis 55 years ago, when an American president is making threats of imminent nuclear action against the nuclear weapons state. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was true, but most of our threats, as Nixon's against North Vietnam, which was a secret he was trying to keep me from revealing, actually, when he hired the Plumbers and sent them after me.
The White House had formed its own Bureau of Investigation, an illegal organization called the Plumbers. It was the Plumbers who had broken into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office.
His threats against North Vietnam were against an ally of the Soviet Union, but not against the nuclear weapons state. The danger now is that, as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, although we're not confronting a superpower like the Soviet Union or Russia, and there's not a danger of nuclear winter because North Korea is the one member of the nine nuclear weapon states that doesn't have enough weapons to cause a nuclear winter that would kill billions by starvation. Even without using nuclear weapons in their artillery against Seoul, and if they do use nuclear weapons in the course of escalation, we'd see more violence in a day or a week than the world has ever seen in that period of time. So they're playing again, as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, chicken, nuclear chicken. And yes, it is very dangerous.
Given this book and the work that you are now revealing to the world about your knowledge of the nuclear program and the work that you did on it, that in some ways I think, you know, contains some more individually explosive observations as any one paragraph of the Pentagon Papers. It's really extraordinary what you've pulled together here. How dangerous is Trump compared to any other president from Truman to now on this issue of nuclear weapons and the first strike policy?
Really, what he says about it is not very new. When he says they should always be on the table, I would never, quote,
I would never take any of my cards off the table.
How about Europe? We won't use it in Europe.
I'm not going to take it off the table.
You might use it in Europe?
No, I don't think so, but
well,
I'm not taking...
Well, just say it. I'll never use a nuclear weapon in Europe.
I am not taking cards off the table. I'm not going to use nukes.
That's what every president has said. Of course, Trump is worrisome because he seems so erratic, impulsive, thin-skinned. I'm not sure that he's crazier than a number of other presidents. In fact, to tell the truth, I have come to believe that he's not crazy. He's just an asshole. And that he's catering to that in a certain segment of the population who admires him for precisely that. I think that Trump's apparent look of craziness has attracted people's attention to dangers that really were always there. And the system that he has command of altogether, the strategic system, which he is rebuilding at the cost over 30 years of more than $1 trillion, a program that was, after all, launched under Barack Obama, and he's continuing and he claims to be even increasing it. If that were actually set into motion, not just rhetorically and by making the kind of use he is making now of pointing the gun, but actually pulling the trigger, that would kill nearly everyone on Earth. Now, no one person, whether it's Trump or anyone else, should have that power. And strictly speaking, I mean, very literally speaking, no nation should have that power. And to have it now in terms of killing everyone, India and Pakistan alone together, without even using thermonuclear weapons, with their fission weapons, the kind that North Korea has, a war between them would starve by nuclear winter, killing harvests from the smoke that blots out the sunlight, would starve up to 2 billion people, a third of the world's population. They don't have a right to have that capability.
You know, it's so deeply embedded in our culture in the United States, this sort of revisionist history of World War II, that the United States heroically got involved in World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The United States led the fight that ultimately defeated Hitler and fascism, and that the definitive action that crushed Japan as a major ally of the fascists in Europe was the not one but two uses of nuclear weapons. Now, what's always absent from that is the support that the United States gave to fascism, you know, in the 1930s, the refusal to aid those who were trying to stop the rise of fascism in Spain. What do you say to people who say, we had to use the nuclear bomb during World War II? It brought a swift end to that bloody war.
They've been lied to. They're ignorant of the actual context of the bomb, which, by the way, was not threatened. It was just used as a fait accompli in an attack on a war which our leaders understood was very possibly going to end without it at the time of the entry of the Soviet Union, which was scheduled to be either on August 15th or they moved it up to August 8th.
On the 8th day of August, 3 days after the one in which the atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, the Soviet Union declared war on the Japanese Empire. This participation had long been expected by the leaders of the Big Three. In April, at the Yalta Conference, Marshal Stalin assured President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill that following the surrender of Germany, Russia would enter the war in the Pacific.
And that was likely to make the Japanese ready to surrender on the terms we wanted. But that, of course, brought the bomb into the world under the most attractive, you know, the only what seemed like justifying auspices. It was an American weapon rather than a fascist weapon, although in its nature, it's the essence of fascism and its ruthlessness and indiscriminate killing of civilians, which, however, we had come to imitate in our strategic bombing program during the war, the British and the Americans, actually went further than Hitler in seeing our air war as a war against civilians above all. And that was a crucial basis for the nuclear era that followed, with nuclear weapons that really can't discriminate between a military target and its surrounding civilians. So the idea was then that this bomb had come in and had been necessary to avoid invasion. That was not true in the eyes of nearly all of the leaders at the time. The American public was not aware of the communications we had intercepted between the imperial headquarters and their own diplomats abroad and the Soviet Union, which showed that they were willing to surrender. They were not planning to fight to the death. So the public didn't know that. So the bomb looked like a miraculous savior of American lives, even Japanese lives, in the end. And that's the way it's seemed ever since. That was a very dangerous opening to the nuclear era for the United States to believe that.
You're famous the world over for so-called Pentagon Papers, but this book tells the story of other documents that you were going to reveal to the world that deal with U.S. nuclear war planning, notes that you took on that program, various studies that were done of classified information. So lay out basically the story that you're telling in this book about the bomb.
I was first going to put out the Pentagon Papers on Vietnam, where the bombs were actually falling at the time. And then what I thought of as the more important information about the preparations for nuclear war that I'd been part of and that I was privy to, I was going to do that after my trial or two. I mean, the first trial was just for copying the Pentagon Papers, not for distributing them. That alone faced me with 115 years in prison, 12 felony counts. I gave them to my brother, as I say, to put them out. He buried them in a trash dump in Tarrytown, New York, and had a green iron stove on top of the bluff where he'd buried them to mark the spot so he could recapture them. Hurricane Doria, Tropical Storm Doria.
A furious lady named Doria, first hurricane to hit the U.S. mainland this season, batters the eastern seaboard from North Carolina to New Jersey. Packing winds up to 75 miles an hour, the storm brings death, destruction, heavy rains, and high tides, causing widespread flooding.
Tropical Storm Doria threw that stove about 100 yards away, dispersed the ground, the bluff, down the road and down the hill and everything, really made it unrecoverable. But a lot of that material has been declassified since.
I think this is incredible. So your brother buries them, then a hurricane whips through, blows the stove away and disperses the ground, so you never actually were able to go back and find any of those documents?
Well, they went back and looked weekend after weekend, actually, for a year and a half. They turned up a lot of green garbage bags in which the box with these papers was, which encompassed it, but none with they found with top secret documents in it. In the end, actually, they found that the trash and ground from that trash heap was being used as fill for a condominium elsewhere, as my brother, and then concrete was going to be poured over it. So he said only dynamite, you know, could get it now, and that wouldn't have preserved the documents very well.
Little do the residents of that building know that they are living on top of some of Daniel Ellsberg's most explosive secrets.
True.
So walk us through what you've laid out in this book and what it's based on.
If war occurred with any conflict with the Soviet Union, this was Eisenhower's emphasis, that there should be no planning because it cost too much for any kind of limited war with the Soviet Union, only all-out war. And that would target every city in the Soviet Union and China, no matter how the war started, over Berlin or an uprising in East Europe or whatever. So that is what has existed all this time. And the reason that would have, by the way, killed everyone is not from the immediate effects or from the radiation, the fallout, pretty much confined to the northern hemisphere. It would be from the smoke from the burning cities, which the firestorms caused by the attacks would loft smoke and soot by the millions of tons into the stratosphere where it wouldn't rain out. And it would envelop the globe in a cloud of smoke and soot that we now know would last for a decade lowering temperatures because it would block the sunlight, 70% of the sunlight, and kill all the harvests worldwide. And nearly everyone would starve to death.
Were there specific projections on the number of deaths that that scenario would cause?
At that time, we didn't know about nuclear winter. Now, I was working on the war plans in 1960, 61, 62, and the concept of nuclear winter arising from this lofted smoke did not arise for another 20 years, till 1983.
Their purpose was to discuss new work by atmospheric scientists, which predicts that the climate of the Earth could change dramatically after a nuclear war, with weeks or months of darkness and intense cold.
No surprise to my colleagues in the Soviet Union, namely that a very large group of prominent biologists in the United States presented with the scenarios.
And even then, it was doubted for quite a while and much confirmed just in the last 10 years. But at that time, rather than thinking that our plans would kill nearly everyone, the answer to the question that I drafted, which was given by the President Kennedy to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was how many would our plans kill if they were carried out as planned? And the answer then was not nearly everyone. It was 600 million people over a matter of months. That would be a fifth of the world's population, but that was an underestimate at that time, including that and including Russian retaliation at that time. You were certainly talking over a billion people in a war that we had initiated as a nuclear war, as an escalation or a preemption. 600 million, 100 Holocausts. I was just stunned that the Joint Chiefs not only knew that, but were willing to say it to the president unapologetically, without resigning, without, and just say, yes, when you give the command, or if we think you would give the command if you had the ability, if there was time, if the communications were in and everything, we would launch a war that would kill 100 Holocausts. And I thought, this is evil and insane. There came to be, since that time, our own first strike would not really be better for our society, for our survival, than a second strike. And that's been true. In other words, all the weapons we're buying in order to limit damage, to make credible our threats of initiating nuclear war, which we're doing right now and we're doing under Obama and now under Trump, and the Russian weapons that Putin is buying. He's spending $1 trillion over the next 30 years, too, on the same kinds of weapons like ours. Parity. In each case, both of us now are making first-use threats. The Russians didn't used to do that because they had a conventional superiority in Europe. They don't now. So they're making the kinds of threats that Eisenhower depended on. So both sides are threatening insane acts, in acts that they now know would kill nearly everyone. It's the system that is not only threatening crazy action, it is crazy. And that doesn't depend on whether it's Trump or not. Yes, it's more worrisome, even under Trump, than under some others. But it's a marginal thing. The fact is that the system is insane.
Of the countries that we're talking about that actually have nuclear weapons, what country, in your view, seems most likely to consider actively using a nuclear weapon in the near future?
Trump seems to be prepared to provoke that action, if possible, by making Kim Jong-un think that he's on the verge of being attacked or conceivably might attack first himself. I think it's doubtful Trump's generals would encourage him or even support him very much in initiating nuclear war, though that's not impossible. But I think more likely they'll say, let Kim initiate the nuclear war and then we'll annihilate North Korea and then we'll show what a monster Kim is by using nuclear weapons against South Korea or Japan or possibly the U.S. So with a weapon on a boat that he sends over in retaliation to being assassinated, which we're rather openly planning to do. So right now, then, both sides are preparing for nuclear war. But the ultimate effect, I think, by the way, of a war with Korea, the effects on South Korea and Japan would be the renewal of testing by everyone, India and Pakistan would get thermonuclear weapons, which they don't have now. There would be new expansions of the arms race by everybody, China, France, along with us and Russia. The Cold War, I think, would then be back irreversibly, and the chance of getting out of this situation would be nil for a generation or more. So we are at a very climactic moment, and Trump is the president who actually has committed himself to a goal which is entirely unachievable, which is the denuclearization of North Korea. That's not going to happen now. Kim Jong-un has reason to believe, with our publicity about assassination squads, decapitation, exercises of invading North Korea, he's not going to let go of the nuclear weapons he does have. He thinks he would be crazy to do that, and that's not the kind of crazy he is. The kind of crazy he is like us in thinking that he would do better to go first than second in such a situation. And our chances of surviving the nuclear age another 70 years, another 100 or 200 years, is low. But I don't think it's zero. My life is devoted to trying to raise those very low risks a little higher. I hope to awaken them to the fact that we are sleepwalking toward an abyss.
Well, and we all thank you for that, Daniel Ellsberg. I hope, particularly, I hope young people read this book, because it's a really important part of history for younger generations to feel a connection to. And thank you very much for writing it and for joining us here on Intercepted.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy. A pleasure.
Daniel Ellsberg is the whistleblower who leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971. His new book is called The Doomsday Machine: Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner.